This is Social Science Bites with me, David Edmonds. Social Science Bites is a series of interviews with leading social scientists and is made in association with Sage Publishing. Some people are lucky. They're just born good at maths. And those who aren't will never be able to compete, however well they're taught. We all know that. Except, according to Joe Bowler of Stanford University, it's not true. In fact, pretty much everything you think about maths education turns out to be a myth. Joe Bowler, welcome to Social Science Bites.
Thank you, David. It's great to be here.
The topic we're talking about today is the maths brain. Now, you've got this incredibly, to my mind, counterintuitive position, which is there's no such thing as a maths brain.
Yes, I think that the neuroscience is showing us pretty clearly that there's no such thing as the maths brain, even though so many people believe that, particularly in the Western culture. But what we know from neuroscience is that mathematical pathways grow in the brain. They grow when you learn something. So the first time you learn something, a tiny, delicate little pathway forms. And then if you go back to that idea, it becomes deeper and deeper until it's a permanent brain pathway. And brains are made up of these pathways that are formed. We're not born with those pathways. They come about when we learn things.
One of the reasons it seems counterintuitive to me is because it goes against my own experience, where I found some parts of maths easy, some parts very difficult. I have two children. One of them finds maths very easy. One of them finds it extremely challenging.
Yes, and I think that's the reason many of us think, well, you're sort of born with something or you're not. But what the neuroscience is telling us is that every moment of your life, every second, you have experiences where brain pathways can begin and grow and deepen. And by the time children are even 3 or 4 years old, they've had many different experiences that have grown different pathways. So, yes, you can have 2 8-year-old children who are completely different, one of whom finds maths easy and one finds it very difficult. But that's much more likely to be because of all the different networks that have developed in their brains. Now, this isn't to say that everybody is born with the same brain, but the experiences we have much more potential to shape brains than anything we're born with. I mean, what we're born with is really eclipsed by the millions of experiences we have.
But just to be clear, you're not saying that if I was taught maths the right way, I could go on to win the Fields Prize, which is the equivalent of a Nobel Prize for mathematics.
Well, I think that's a question that nobody knows the answer to, actually. I would say this, that if you were taught the right way, with the right messages, and the messages turn out to be very important as well, that you could excel in all levels of maths in school, definitely. We could take any child and have them studying calculus, A-level maths, whatever. How far can people go? It's, I think, an open question that nobody really knows the answer to.
Well, you've carried out your own research. Mm-hmm. Looking at what works and what doesn't work with maths education. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. So in my own research, I have contrasted students working in different ways. There's a lot of contention. People have a lot of ideas about what's good in maths. So I decided to study it, and I followed hundreds of students over many years, some of whom have sat in rows listening to a teacher lecture and then repeating exercises, and others of which have actively explored with mathematical ideas, being much more sort of actively involved, applying methods, working on challenging problems. So in one, there's a kind of repeat and practice method, and the other is explore, be active. And I've studied this in England, I've studied in the US, and in both cases, the kids who were more actively involved in their learning did a lot better, did better in standardized tests, did better in life.
And by active learning, you mean that they are engaged in a problem and aren't just told to learn times tables by rote, for example?
Yes, the times tables by rote issue is a very big issue because many of us did that. We memorized times tables, and it turns out you don't need to do that. It's much better actually to have a really strong number sense, which you don't get from memorizing times tables. You get from really working conceptually with numbers. But in general, that's true, that kids learning by rote, learning by memory, do not do as well as kids who are thinking hard and conceptually about mathematics. And I work with the PISA team. The PISA team conduct international tests across the world, and a couple of years ago, they studied maths in particular and looked at kids' strategies in maths and divided the world up. There were 13 million 15-year-olds into the strategies they used. And the lowest performing kids across the world were the kids who used a memorization strategy in maths. In every country, the memorizers were the lowest achievers. In any country with high numbers of memorizers, scored lowly in the world. The US is one of those countries and the UK is one of those countries. Both of them have high numbers of memorizers.
One of the other strange results is that it's good to make mistakes in mathematics. One learns from error.
Yeah. So there's so much that needs to change in maths education. And one of the things is lots of kids are sitting there thinking, I don't have a maths brain. And then when they make a mistake, that's more evidence that they don't have a maths brain. And what we know is it's actually really productive to make a mistake. And the best times for brain growth are when your brain is struggling and when you're making mistakes. That's when, in studies, they've found the brains are kind of on fire with growth in those times. So we have ourselves worked with students where we've given them these brain messages and we've told them it's really good to make mistakes. And it has changed everything for them.
Let me ask you about testing. Here in Britain, kids are now tested from a very young age. They have to answer certain questions in a certain amount of time. And it's a way of measuring what progress they're making.
Yeah.
Is that something we should welcome, that development towards more and more testing?
No, it's not something we should do. And in fact, we know that timed tests actually inhibit the brain from working. So one of the recent findings is that when people feel anxious, and if you put a maths test in front of someone in a timed position, they start to feel anxious, the working memory in the brain becomes compromised. If you need to recall maths facts, you need your working memory. And so the worst thing we can do with little kids is give them timed math tests. In the US, where I work, people have seen this brain research and they're pulling time tests out of schools and out of districts. But the UK has gone down the complete opposite road.
How else would you test them, though? We do need to assess how well the teachers are doing, how well the school is doing. What would be a better way of assessing student progress?
Yeah, so assessment is good and helpful for students, teachers, all sorts of people. First of all, math should not be a speed race. And in fact, one of the things that we advocate for is dissociating math from speed altogether. This is another damaging myth that people have, that to be good at math, you have to be fast at maths. Turns out that's not true. And in fact, a lot of the world's greatest mathematicians will tell you they're very slow with maths. They need to think deeply and they can't work fast. They don't do well on time tests. So dissociating maths from speed is really important. We can assess students, and good teachers are assessing their students all the time. They know how well students are doing. And we wrote a paper, it's called Fluency Without Fear. It's had millions of downloads because it shares the brain evidence about how bad time tests are for children and then gives teachers other ways of teaching students math facts really well and deeply with activities and games. Kids love them and teachers love them, and we don't need to be giving timed assessments to young children at all. You look at countries like Finland, which tops the world in maths achievement. Finnish children don't take a test all through school, but then when they take an international test, they top the world in their performance. So it's kind of a myth that to have kids do well on tests, we should give them more tests. It's like saying, you know, we want our children to grow tall, so we'll measure them a lot.
You've mentioned several times the idea that there are myths in maths education. And one myth is that there is a maths brain. Does the very fact that there is a myth affect maths performance?
Yes, absolutely. And it's very sad. We have nations of maths traumatized people, and a lot of that trauma comes down from myths. The biggest myth is the myth of the math brain, that you either have one or you don't, you're born with one or you're not. But one of the things we know is what you believe about yourself actually changes your cognition.
What's the evidence for that?
Yeah, so some of this evidence comes from Carol Dweck and her work on mindset, which is very well known. And she has shown, she and other colleagues through many years, that people with a growth mindset who believe that they can learn anything do better in all sorts of walks of life. And people with a fixed mindset who think my intelligence is kind of fixed do not do as well. But a recent study by Jason Moser and his colleagues was fascinating. They had people under brain scans, and they found that if you make a mistake and you have a growth mindset, and you believe in yourself, that moment of mistake, your brain is sort of on fire with growth. But if you make a mistake and you have a fixed mindset, you don't get as much brain growth. So if you're going around believing in yourself and making mistakes, as everybody does, your brain benefits from those. But if you're going around thinking, I'm not very good, and you make a mistake, your brain is not going to get the same benefit.
Boys are traditionally thought better at maths than girls. Yes. Another myth?
Yes. So if you look at school performance, boys don't do better than girls at maths. Test performance, you can find that. And this is something really interesting. So in the recent PISA international tests, on the individual math tests, boys did better than girls in 34 countries. When they factored in anxiety, that gender difference went away completely. So this tells us that girls are more anxious in maths tests than boys, and that undermines their performance. But also fascinating, the PISA team just released the results of a collaborative problem-solving test. Students took it individually on a computer, and it was a test of maths and science and reading, but they had to interact with a computer agent. So they had to take on this computer agent's point of view and solve problems. In that test, girls did better than boys in 52 countries, every country tested. We know that just the way people perceive tests will affect how well they do on them. So here you have this test of collaborative problem solving, you're interacting, even though you're interacting with a computer agent. Maybe that just alleviates that anxiety. That's one possibility.
This is a deeply entrenched belief, this gendered brain. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering how one can overcome it, because you're suggesting that if you could overcome the belief, you would get different results.
Yeah, I think we see that over and over again. We recently brought 81 students onto campus, and we'd gone out to school districts in the US and said, can you give us students who've had a bad maths experience? And the school district leader said, oh yes, we have lots of those students. So we brought 81 students onto campus. Every one of them said on the first day, I'm not a math person. They could name the one person in their class they thought was the maths person. Anyway, we taught them for 18 lessons, so it was pretty short. And we gave them all these brain science results. We told them that mistakes are really good, your brains grow, there's no such thing as a maths person. And we taught them open conceptual maths. In 18 days, they improved their test performance, so they took a standardized test. They learned the equivalent of 2.5 years of school in 18 days. And I know, because we've studied the kids, and I know that a big part of this boost for them was they changed their ideas about who they were and what they could do.
One thing that fascinates me about your research is that you're a social scientist, but you constantly reference neuroscience.
Yes, I began, I think, that journey when I started at Stanford a few years ago. First of all, I met with Carol Dweck, who's also at Stanford, and she referenced a lot the brain science on synapses fire when you make a mistake. And then I myself kind of met with a neuroscientist, and now I work with them and publish with them. So I'm actually in a collaborative group with a set of neuroscientists. We recently wrote papers on the importance of visual thinking. One of the things that we wrote, which has been taken up by newspapers all across the US, which I thought was an amazing piece of evidence in neuroscience, is the value of fingers. It turns out that even when we ask adults to work on a maths problem, an area of the brain lights up that's seeing fingers. So when we work with fingers, it develops that area of the brain that's very mathematical. So now they know that this is why musicians are better at maths. When I dug into this more, I found all these brain scientists, including leading UK brain scientists, saying, you know, if kids don't know fingers, a whole sort of number part of their brain will never develop properly.
When you say no fingers, you mean their dexterity with fingers?
The neuroscientists call it finger perception. And the test for finger perception, and you can try this with kids, is to put your hand under a table or a piece of paper and have someone touch fingertips. You don't know which finger's being touched, and ask people which finger is being touched and how well you know your individual fingers. So the amount that college students know their fingers predicts their scores on calculation tests. I mean, it's kind of mind-blowing. So yes, we're publishing this work with the neuroscientists.
How important is it that we get maths education right? I studied maths all the way through my education, and some bits like calculus and differentiation I found really difficult. I have never used it ever since. Does this really matter that we get maths education right for the vast majority of the population rather than just the elite few who end up using it at a high level?
Yes, I would say it's very important, and it's very important for the reasons you say. The way we teach maths now, most people don't ever use it. They never see any use for those sort of that traditional teaching they've had. But quantitative literacy, where people can make sense of the world around them, interpret mortgages, and it's not just numerical. We're using maths when we park a car, when we do anything spatial, when we work out how we're going to plan our day. So what's important is this kind of mathematical literacy, being flexible with numbers and ideas and space and shape. But that's quite different from what we give kids in school. So I would say maths is important for everyone, but we really should be changing quite drastically the kind of maths we do with kids in school.
Underlying your research is an egalitarian ethos, which is that we can all do maths. That, I imagine, is a controversial position to take.
Yeah, I think it's turned out to be controversial. I didn't know it would be, but I've been publishing for a while the results that when we teach really well, everybody can learn maths and learn it well. And of course, it is an equitable sort of position, and we can bring about equitable results when we teach well. That turns out to be pretty controversial. And I have come to the conclusion over many years that some people actually don't want that. Some people kind of like things the way they are, that some people are allowed to go on and do very well with maths and others aren't, and that's kind of the way society should be.
People talk about culture wars. There are maths wars as well.
Right. Yeah, there are maths wars, particularly in the US. In the maths wars, people were pitched against each other quite violently. On the one side, if you like, there were people who said, we want kids sitting in rows with teachers lecturing at them. And on the other were a lot of educators who said, no, that's not what we want. We want kids actively learning. But amazing things happened in the math wars, with people really coming after each other and, you know, attacking each other both verbally and in other ways. And there was even people who went on a hunger strike because of textbook adoption in one place. So people get extremely heated and extremely, you know, emotional about what maths textbook is used in schools.
You were invited to the White House to talk about some of your maths education, which is a fantastic accolade for a social scientist. That was under Obama. We now have Donald Trump in the White House. Have you noticed a change in the attitude to your research?
I have noticed some change, yes. So a few years ago, I was invited to the White House actually to talk about STEM and girls and getting more girls and women in STEM. So what's changed, I think, is now I feel that there is a feeling in the air that equity is not as desired by some people, and that, I mean, I've always known that there are some people who don't want equitable outcomes, but it feels like those people who don't want equitable outcomes have been given a voice.
Joe Bowler, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Social Science Bites is made in association with Sage Publishing. For more interviews, go to socialsciencespace.com.